Hey there, friends. A quick favor. We are conducting a brief audience survey. We'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes to provide your answers. Please visit survey.prx.org/world to complete it. That's survey.prx.org/world. Thank you. For the second year in a row, the coronavirus interrupts the busy Lunar New Year in China.
If I travel back home right now, what happens if things get worse?
Travel plans on hold. I'm Marco Werman. Also today, bipartisan calls for a 9/11 style commission into the Capitol insurrection. An expert tells us what it could achieve.
Until there's a common baseline of understanding of what happened, you're going to have nothing but heat and very little light in terms of these debates.
And the White House says it wants to close Guantanamo, but first the Biden administration wants a formal review of the U.S. military prison.
My first reaction is rage and disbelief that yet another review would be needed.
Those stories and a virtual carnival today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to have you with us. Locking down cities, building quarantine centers, disinfecting streets, and mass testing. That's what China's done to control the spread of COVID. They've reported fewer than 5,000 deaths from the coronavirus. Still, many Chinese are not taking any chances. The Lunar New Year is the launch of a 40-day travel season. It's typically the largest human migration on the planet. This year, though, 48 million people have decided to celebrate the holiday by staying in place. The World's Rebecca Canther spoke with a few of them.
At Yew Gardens, a popular Shanghai tourist spot, visitors are doing a bit of Chinese New Year shopping and taking in the sights. Red lanterns, red door posters, red everything. Even with face masks, health codes, and temperature checks, the atmosphere here is festive. Huang Yun is selling New Year's decorations at an open-air market here. She says it's nowhere near as crowded as in years past. In a normal year, you'd really have to push to get through the crowds, she says. I think tourists are down by two-thirds this year. Jiang Ke is walking back to the construction site where he works. Usually at this time of year, he'd be heading home to see his family in Shanxi province. I wanted to go, he says, but because of the ongoing pandemic, we've been told to stay in Shanghai. So I'll keep working. The pay is double. The government hasn't actually forbidden travel this year, but they're strongly discouraging it. Zhang says he and his colleagues listened. We decided not to go because we didn't want to trouble our families, he says. We'd have to do a COVID test and quarantine. It just seemed too much of a bother. Traveling home to be with family during the week-long holiday is the one time many people here get to see their children or elderly family members. Many schools and workplaces have suggested people not travel unless necessary. Some cities even offered small financial incentives to stay put. Tracy Dai works at a Shanghai marketing research firm. She says advertisers switched up their ad campaigns too.
A lot of brands were really taking that Chinese New Year and homesickness for the promotion, for the marketing of their brands.
Instead of showing the usual teary family reunions, the theme this year is being apart. This Budweiser beer commercial on China's version of TikTok features blue-collar workers calling their families instead of traveling home. Dai also chose not to travel this year, although her home village is just 3 hours away by high-speed train. This will be her first time spending the holiday without her family. She says that the risk of the virus is partly just an excuse.
Because I'm already in my 30s and I haven't been married yet. And then that's why every single time when you go back, my mom is fine, but like my grandparents, oh, they were just pushing me so much.
She's celebrating this year with friends, sharing food from their hometowns, drinking and playing board games. Most are single like her. But she says memories from last year's lockdown and the rise in COVID cases in places like Shanghai and Hebei in the past month are also playing into people's decision not to travel.
We were worried about, oh, if I travel back home right now, what happens if things get worse? The coronavirus, if it gets worse, I'm locked down, you know, in my own hometown. I can't get back to the city to work. that's one of the little concerns as well.
Usually, this train station in Shanghai would be packed with travelers around the holiday. But this year, it's less busy. Yashu Zhang and her mother debated canceling their plans to take a 16-hour trip to their home village in Hunan province. But in the end, they decided to go.
I was a little bit concerned how the people in my mom's hometown would think about this.
Her relatives told her that even though both Shanghai and Hunan are considered low-risk areas, the local government was warning it might require 14 days quarantine and COVID tests every 7 days. Once they arrived, though, things were not as strict.
We just went to the local neighborhood, the residential committee, Juwei Hui. We went to register and like put down our names, show our test report. And that was it. Like, no one told us, don't walk around, don't go to visit your relatives. There was nothing like that.
Zhang says that people's decision to travel or not was less about the risk of COVID-19 than it was about unpredictable policies made by local governments terrified of an outbreak.
There's nothing too specified or very clear. So everybody is trying to understand the real policy.
For those not traveling, they're still finding ways to celebrate the new year. There are video calls to family, feasts with nearby friends, and you know hongbao, those iconic red envelopes filled with cash. People are sending money by phone instead. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
Former President Donald Trump was acquitted in his second impeachment trial on Saturday of inciting insurrection. So how do we move forward after an armed attack on the Capitol? To start with, some lawmakers are calling for a 9/11-style commission to investigate. Here's House impeachment manager and Democratic Congresswoman Madeleine Dean speaking on ABC.
People were terrorized. This was incited by the President of the United States. Of course there must be a full commission, an impartial commission, not guided by politics.
I'm joined now by John Farmer, senior counsel and team leader on the 9/11 Commission, and now a law professor at Rutgers University. So the 9/11 Commission made recommendations for how to avoid a similar event from happening again. Were those recommendations followed, and what has been the overall impact?
Well, to a large extent, they were. The report that we issued caused a major reshuffling of the intelligence apparatus in the country, and also transformed emergency response in the way that emergency response is handled across the country. So as government reports go, it was, I think, uniquely successful in having the vast majority of its recommendations implemented.
So we've had commissions formed after major impactful events. There was also the Warren Commission that looked into JFK's assassination in 1963. How would you imagine a commission forming around investigating what happened on January 6th, the insurrection? What would be the goal, and what do we need to find out?
I think we need to find out the basic facts. I mean, we still don't know a lot. We don't know what kind of contacts there were, if any, between the president and or his advisors and the people who are planning the violence on January 6th. We don't know what the president was doing in that critical interval when the Capitol is under attack, and that attack was met by silence from the White House. So I think there's an abundance of facts that need to be investigated. And I think a 9/11 type commission is the best opportunity to do that.
So what do you think were the most useful aspects of the 9/11 commission that you think could be critical for a 1/6 commission, if you can call it that? As you say, locking in the truth, even though some lawmakers might not still want to face the facts.
Well, I think there's an inherent value in establishing the timeline of exactly what happened, who said what to whom, what communications were ongoing back and forth. Was there an awareness on the part of people who should have known better that the allegations of widespread voter fraud were simply not true and were in fact fraudulent? And what role did that drumbeat of false claims, as Senator McConnell said, from the biggest megaphone in the world, what effect did that have on the people who actually showed up? How many of the people who showed up actually showed up intending to do what they did at the Capitol? How many got caught up in the emotion of the moment and the president's rhetoric? All these questions have yet to be answered. So I think there's an intrinsic value in establishing those facts. And I think what's missing in the country right now is a common baseline understanding of even how our government is supposed to operate. If we have a large segment of the population that does not understand how our government is supposed to work, we're in big trouble because, you know, unlike other nations, you know, we're not defined by an ethnicity or by a religious faith. We're defined by a common understanding of what our government is about. And that's been eroded seriously over the last few years, and that needs to be restored. And I think a commission like this is one way to restore that.
I'm just curious, what was your personal reaction? What is still your reaction to what happened on January 6th?
I was shocked and deeply saddened because to me, that was sort of the coup de grace in a process that was a long time in the making, where our institutions are being discredited on a daily basis by our adversaries and even by some of the people here. Never thought I would see a mob take over the Capitol, even for a short period of time. You know, 9/11, they had to evacuate the Capitol, and there was that fear in the air that the Capitol might be struck by one of the hijacked planes. And I, you know, you could sort of see that because it was a transnational threat, but this was internal. This was Americans attacking their own Capitol, and that's a tragedy. How we got to that point is something I think we all need to understand in order to move forward in a constructive way.
Well, let me just ask you about that, because one of the big takeaways from the 9/11 Commission was that intelligence was siloed in the lead up to 9/11 among law enforcement agencies, the CIA and FBI, most notably. The conclusion was to have greater interoperability. So we don't have a January 6th Commission yet, but what needs to get fixed writ large to prevent another January 6th, do you think?
Well, I think it was a wake-up call. Part of the work that I've been involved in at Rutgers at the Eaglin Institute for the last year has been writing reports calling attention to the rise of the Boogaloo movement, for example. We wrote a report on QAnon back in June, warning that this could be a tremendously violent group. And so we were warning people that something like this could happen. And I think it was in the Washington Post. One of my former colleagues actually wrote a report for the Capitol Police on January 3rd, I think, basically saying that, you know, this is coming and Congress will be the target. So it was not a failure of intelligence. It was a failure, I think, to take it seriously.
John Farmer, what do you think is the difference between how the 9/11 Commission ran and, say, something like a Truth and Reconciliation Commission? Is one more useful than the other in this instance?
I don't see them as that different, to be honest. The challenge for this is going to be that in the case of the 9/11 Commission, fault could be assigned to two administrations, right? The Clinton administration and the Bush administration, and both had lapses that resulted in these events. In this case, you know, it's really all on one side, and it might be very difficult to get hardcore Republican supporters of the president to agree to participate in a commission like this. But I think that enough of them went through that day, had to run for their lives and remember that they should want to know what happened. In that sense, I don't think that this kind of commission would differ much from either the 9/11 Commission or a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which other countries have had.
Final question, and it is a big concern these days. How could a commission like this fight disinformation and misinformation?
That's the key, right? We are learning just how toxic an environment social media can be for the spread of disinformation and misinformation. And what we found in studying groups like the Boogaloos and QAnon is that actually the social media platforms, and not intentionally, but they organize these groups. Because if you say something in a communication, the algorithms pick you up and say, oh, you might want to talk to so-and-so. He has similar views. And so they are complicit in actually organizing some of these extremist groups. And that has to be addressed. And I think there's a need for viewing people's personal data and the information that's sort of swept up by social media as a public trust. When radio and television first came into existence, there was a recognition of the danger of telescoping people's information so they get it from only one source. No similar recognition accompanied the advent of social media. And I think we need to go back to that kind of model. There used to be something called the fairness doctrine. Yeah. Recognizing that the danger of getting information from only one source, the networks were obliged to present multiple points of view. That went out the window with cable, the theory being that there were multiple outlets and therefore it didn't matter. But I think what the last decades have shown us is that it does matter. And people are getting their information largely from single sources. I mean, those sources are ideologically motivated. It results in the kind of split we have now. So viewing our social media presence as a public trust, I think, is the first step toward figuring out the proper way to regulate it so that we can control this tsunami of disinformation that's out there.
John Farmer was senior counsel and team leader on the 9/11 Commission. He's also a professor of law at Rutgers University. John, thank you for your time and thoughts today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on the show, Super Mario steps up in Italy. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. After being Ebola-free for nearly 5 years, the government of Guinea in West Africa has announced an Ebola epidemic. You'll recall that Guinea was one of the countries worst affected by the Ebola epidemic that lasted from 2014 to 2016. That epidemic killed more than 11,000 people. Now Guinea's government is racing to stop this Ebola outbreak before it gets out of hand. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi reports.
Guinea's government says the first detected case of this Ebola epidemic began at a funeral. It was for a local nurse who died last month in the southern town of Gueke. It's not clear whether she died of Ebola herself, but soon after the funeral, attendees began showing the telltale signs of the disease: diarrhea, vomiting, and bleeding. Seven of them have since tested positive for the Ebola virus. At least three of them have died.
On a décidé de faire une déclaration officielle de cette situation d'épidémie.
We're declaring an epidemic, says Sakuba Keita of Guinea's National Agency of Health Security. He spoke at a press conference yesterday when health officials held a crisis meeting to discuss the Ebola cases. Less than 5 years ago, they were battling an Ebola epidemic that killed thousands of people in West Africa. It eventually spread to nine other countries, including the United States. But this time, Guinean health officials say they have a plan.
La deuxième, c'est la poursuite du recensement de tous les cas suspects et les contacts.
Keita says health officials are sending out investigation teams to southern Guinea to do contact tracing, to identify everyone who attended the funeral. That's to limit the spread of this epidemic. Another priority is vaccination. According to the World Health Organization, there are two licensed Ebola vaccines.
Et vacciner les gens qui ont été exposés pour limiter.
Keita said the priority is to vaccinate those who might have been exposed to Ebola in order to limit and interrupt the transmission of the virus. Last month, the World Health Organization announced the creation of a global stockpile of the Ebola vaccine to help respond quickly to outbreaks like this one. Vaccine campaigns have already begun in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where another Ebola outbreak was declared last week. But Sakuba Keita, the health official from Guinea, said prevention is key.
Les mesures de prévention, le premier d'abord, c'est le lavage des mains.
Wash your hands, he said, and don't touch items that belonged to an infected person. Not too different from preventing the spread of the coronavirus, which, of course, Guinea is also dealing with right now. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
Mario Draghi was sworn in as Italy's prime minister over the weekend. That ends months of uncertainty for Italians after the country's governing coalition collapsed in January. Draghi is an economist and former head of the European Central Bank. He's now tasked with leading Italy through a pandemic and its worst economic crisis since World War II. For more on this, I'm joined by Lorenzo Codogno. He's a visiting professor at the London School of Economics and a former head of the Italian Treasury. So Draghi is credited with saving the euro during his time at the European Central Bank, Lorenzo, but that's a notch in his belt from nearly 10 years ago. What does it mean for Italians that Draghi is now leading the country?
Well, I think it was strategy by President Mattarella to bring Draghi in as prime minister, and he enjoys a strong support in the country. The result is that he now enjoys quite a large support by parties from both the center-left and the center-right, with very few exceptions. So I think it was a good choice. He certainly has a great reputation internally and externally, and it's certainly a good choice to lead Italy out of this very difficult moment.
Draghi's first job, presuming he wins this week's vote of confidence in Parliament, will be to decide how Italy will spend more than 200 billion euros from the EU's COVID-19 recovery fund. What does Italy need to do to get those funds?
Italy has to prepare what is called National Recovery and Resilience Plan to submit it to Brussels. The final deadline is in April, but possibly by the end of this month. Now, Italy is not starting from scratches because the previous government has already prepared the draft. And some of the people in government right now were actually advisors to the previous prime minister. So I think it wouldn't take that much to finalize this plan. And I think the plan is not, it would include investments, public investments, along the lines suggested by the Commission, so to facilitate the environmental transition and also to facilitate digitalization in the economy. The difficult bit is to attach to this investment plan structural reforms.
The previous government collapsed after it could not decide on an economic plan. Italy is known for political instability. So how likely is it that a technocrat like Mario Draghi will find cross-party support for these pretty substantive reforms?
Well, this is what President Mattarella called a national unity government. So effectively, it is not a political government, although there are political ministers. But I mean, it's like after a war, you know, you have a big shock and you need to come together and try to help the country to recover. And this is the philosophy underlying this government. Once this is over, probably we will go back to normal political infighting. But I think for now, there are, you know, some break with the normal behavior, and everybody is actually expected to cooperate and work together for the benefit of the country and for the benefit of the recovery in the country.
Just based on what you just said, I mean, this does seem to speak to the level of faith Italians have in Mario Draghi to get things right.
There are very high expectations. Unfortunately, clearly, you cannot change the problems of the country overnight. But Draghi is the right person to unite the country behind the program to deliver structural reforms and good investment, because that is really what is needed right now.
One more thing, Lorenzo. Under an EU agreement, 37% of this EU stimulus money must be allocated to making the Italian economy greener. What could that look like in Italy? And do you think that target will actually be met?
I think it will certainly be met. I mean, it's rather flexible target. In other words, you can, green investment can cut a number of issues. You know, you can restructure house, public buildings and stuff like that in a way that is environmentally friendly and can save energy. You can redo infrastructure works in a way that doesn't really impinge on the environment. So, you know, you can do a lot of things that can actually be defined within the remit of green investment without entering into what is called greenwashing, so to speak. But proper environmental investment can still be done in a way that is also a good investment for the country for the money spent.
Lorenzo Codogno is a former head of the Italian Treasury. He's been speaking with us about newly sworn in Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi. Lorenzo, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. Hello, it's Marco. In October of last year, we set an ambitious goal of raising $100,000 for The World, the radio show, and the podcast. Before the end of 2020, we had raised over $118,000. This is an incredible feat we could have not done alone. Here are some of the people who made that possible. Camilo De La Rosa, Tatiana Schreiber, the Herman family, Adrian Gallegos, Mary Paz, Brandon Norgard, Nina Lau, Marcel in British Columbia, Rusha Lev, and Gutz Berkel. You rock. Thanks to everybody who answered the call and for those who continue to listen in every day to the show. A landmark ruling, the oil company Shell can be tried in British court for its polluting operations in Nigeria's Delta region.
Finally, it's been confirmed that these corporations cannot destroy the Niger Delta and just run back home to enjoy the profits.
Residents hope compensation for oil spills comes next. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We come to you from GBH Boston and PRX. If you think the vaccine rollout in your neck of the woods is going slowly, it's probably still faster than most other places around the world. About half the countries on Earth have yet to receive a single dose. The first shipment for Colombia arrives there today. The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia has been tracking the vaccine rollout across the region. So it's been more than 2 months, Jorge, since the United States and other wealthy countries began vaccinating their people. It's not a perfect picture by any means. The process in Colombia, though, it's just beginning. Why is that?
Well, Marco, it's a complex question because there are many factors that contribute here. But really, the biggest one is income. You have, of course, the high-income countries, Canada, United States, Western Europe. Then you have the middle-income countries, Colombia, most of Latin America among them. And then you have the low-income countries that are the ones that are coming last. Now, each country is making deals with the pharmaceuticals to receive these shipments, but these deals are confidential. So we don't actually know the price of the vaccines, but that is an important factor that is contributing here. I spoke to Andres Vecino. He is an international health researcher at Johns Hopkins University. And he says, yes, price is a very important factor. He says there's a few other things too.
These might be related to the prices agreed, but also might be related to other type of things. So when countries receive vaccines, they need some regulatory framework to receive them. They need approvals, which usually, and at this point, are most of them are emergency authorizations for use. They need distribution lines ready. They need specific refrigerators for some of these vaccines. These things are also related to income. It may be related to prices, but also to other factors that are related to income in each of these countries.
Yeah, Marco. So what Vecino is saying is that the country's income also contributes to the speed that they can get the vaccine to their population. And he says that really that's what matters, not when the vaccine comes in, but how quickly the country can get the vaccine to the people who are at highest risk among the population.
Yeah. So, for example, Chile and Mexico were the first countries in the region to receive vaccines, but I gather they've had very different levels of success at getting those doses out, getting them in people's arms. Why is that?
That's right, Marco. Chile has been, relatively speaking, a success story because Chile in the past month was able to get vaccines to almost 2 million people. So in a country of 19 million people, that is a very high rate of vaccinations. Now, Chile health officials say that one of the reasons that they believe they've had success is because of pre-existing trade deals that they had with other countries and their ability to do negotiations. Another reason why Chile has perhaps been more successful is because Chile is a much smaller country, and also Chile is largely urbanized, whereas Mexico, a significantly larger country, 130 million people, and large swaths of the population living in rural areas. So going back to the point that Andres Vecino at Hopkins was making is that the date that you receive the vaccine, very important, but also how quickly you can get to your population, even more important.
And Jorge, one footnote on Colombia, a national survey I see found 40% of the population, for whatever reason, they don't want to be vaccinated. So how big of a challenge does that present the government there?
That's right, Marco. This is similar to what we have seen in the United States and many other countries. Many people don't want to receive vaccines, and it's for very complex reasons. Even some people who trust the science are skeptical about the vaccines because of, for example, the speed at which they were rolled out. But ultimately, right now, that is still far down the road for Colombia because Colombia just received 50,000 vaccines today, and that's in a country of 50 million people, and they're going to start giving out those vaccines on Wednesday. So educating the population is going to be important, but that's still something that is a little bit of ways away for countries that are just now getting the vaccines or still haven't gotten them.
The World's Jorge Valencia in Mexico City. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
If you're looking for another way to connect with us, start your morning with a quick hit of news stories from around the globe. You don't have to go digging for it. Our team at The World will email it to you so you can start the day informed. Sign up for our morning newsletter, Top of the World, on our website. That's theworld.org/newsletters. Again, theworld.org/newsletters. The U.S. detention facility in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, is back in the news for two reasons. It's the subject of a new legal drama starring Jodie Foster called The Mauritanian. It's also in the sight lines of the White House. President Biden says he wants to close the detention center before he leaves office. The administration is now conducting a review with that goal in mind. But former prisoners, lawyers for current detainees, and human rights activists say they've heard that before. The World's Rupa Shenoy reports.
The Guantanamo Bay Detention Center was set up after 9/11 to house foreign suspects in the so-called War on Terror. It became known for interrogation methods that some say are essentially state-sponsored torture. Nearly 800 men from 49 different nations have been detained there over the years. Moazzam Beg was one of them for 3 years. He's a British-Pakistani national who now runs CAGE, a London-based group that advocates for an end to war on terror injustices.
There are people in Guantanamo who've gone through waterboarding. They've gone through beatings. They've gone through sexual, physical, and religious humiliation. I won't say that Guantanamo is the worst prison in the world, but is the most notorious one because it's run by the most powerful nation in the world that claims to be a bastion of democracy, human rights, and freedom.
40 men remain at the Guantanamo prison at a cost to U.S. taxpayers of $13 million each annually. Some are regarded as so-called forever prisoners with life sentences. If their cases are heard, it's by military commissions instead of civilian courts. Beg welcomes the Biden administration's expressed intention to close Guantanamo, but questions the need for a review.
The problem is that almost every U.S. president, including the one who opened it, George Bush, says that he wanted to close Guantanamo. So this notion of should this place be closed, should the prisoners be freed, isn't one that should require a lot more investigation and discussion and robust investigations inside and outside. It should have been done a long time ago.
He's not the only one who feels that way.
My first reaction is rage and disbelief that yet another review would be needed and that there would be any hesitation about the need to close Guantanamo.
Alka Pradhan is Human Rights Counsel at the Guantanamo Bay Military Commissions, representing Omar al-Balushi, one of the men accused in the 9/11 attacks. Just by its continued existence, she says, the prison at Guantanamo undermines America's credibility and moral authority and gives other countries an excuse to commit human rights atrocities.
If there's willingness on the part of the administration to listen to all sides, to gather that info, to assess it fairly, understand that Guantanamo has actually served to undermine our national security, then I'm sure they'll arrive at the right decision. The only question then is whether they have the courage politically to carry out that decision.
Part of the problem, Pradhan says, is that there's still the perception that Guantanamo holds the worst of the worst.
And that's just not true. And all the information that's come out has shown us that's not true. It's provably not true.
In a recent report, Amnesty International recommended Biden issue an executive order to immediately close Guantanamo. Pradhan says the military continues to torture prisoners there in violation of international law and that her own client's health is deteriorating. UN human rights experts recently joined the call for Guantanamo to close because of cruel and inhuman conditions affecting the remaining detainees' health. Pradhan doubts it's a coincidence that all the men held at Guantanamo are Muslim.
People still raise their eyebrows when I say Guantanamo Bay is a racist institution. Like, where else do you have a prison for only one ethnic religious group? It's specifically against international law.
Yet Guantanamo is nearing 20 years in existence. Moazzam Beg says that's a milestone the Biden administration should be mindful of.
Biden has his opportunity to leave the world. I mean, I think he said that when in his inauguration speech that the world would judge us on these large issues. So he's right about that. The world will judge and is looking to and still talking about if he is the president of the United States of America when Guantanamo passes its 20th anniversary, he will have that as part of his legacy.
Meanwhile, Beg says he welcomes the release of The Mauritanian, the new Hollywood film about a Guantanamo detainee. He says it humanizes the people held in detention by the U.S. Beg says maybe the American people will start to see them as individual men struggling with an unfair system, not just faceless terrorists. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Another landmark victory for environmental activists fighting pollution in Nigeria. They, along with residents in Nigeria's oil-rich Delta region, took the multinational company Shell to court in the UK. On Friday, the Supreme Court there ruled that two Nigerian communities of more than 50,000 people can sue the British-Dutch company in English courts. Locals want compensation for oil spills and pollution that have devastated their farmland and fishing grounds. The decision comes shortly after a Dutch court also held Shell responsible for oil spills in the Niger Delta. To find out how residents of the Niger Delta are responding, we reached out to Nimo Bassi. He's an environmental justice activist in Benin City, Nigeria. So Friday's decision, Nimo, came from thousands of miles away in a British court. How do locals feel about it in the Delta?
Well, there are two reactions. One is that it's a shame that they cannot obtain this kind of justice and judgments in Nigerian courts. Wherever they do receive such judgments, the corporations simply ignore them. Then on the second level, people are extremely happy. They've seen that finally is being confirmed one after the other that these corporations cannot destroy the Niger Delta and just run back home to enjoy the profits. So people are saying, yes, judgment has come.
And why do the courts in Nigeria just ignore the grievances of people in the Delta? And what could this ruling mean for courts in Nigeria? Maybe could they take it more seriously now?
Many of us do hope that the courts in Nigeria would sit up to the reality of the situation. And actually, the political system, it's not just the court. The courts have been making rulings that the corporations simply ignore. For example, in 2005, there was a judgment in a high court right here in Benin City against Shell that ruled on a case brought by a community in Delta State on gas flaring. And the high court judge declared that gas flaring was totally illegal and was against the human rights of the people. And they demanded that Shell should stop flaring gas. And Shell is still flaring gas in that community, even as we speak, without the judgment being challenged or vacated.
Sorry, when you say deflaring gas, you mean burning gas off on these kind of giant smokestacks?
Yes, burning gas that comes out of the oil wells. They will have giant furnaces across the Niger Delta that have been burning day and night for over 60 years, nonstop for over 60 years, just to burn, destroy the environment, pollute the air, and get a lot of people sick.
So why is this ruling so important? What do you hope it means for the everyday lives of people in the Niger Delta, the region you grew up in?
The judgments are very vital to the people because the cases have been quite emblematic of the level of devastation that the simply irresponsible actions of oil corporations have brought to their communities. There's been a lot of struggles to get justice, to stop oil spills and pipeline breakages. And the oil corporations often decide when cases are very hard against them, when they cannot deny the evidence, they often settle out of court. But in this case, the decision in the Netherlands took 13 years to reach.
That's the judgment that was made at the end of January.
Yeah. The next step is getting them to pay for it. So people are believing that time has now come for the oil companies to realize that there's actually no way to hide. They can't pollute, destroy the Niger Delta, then run back home. And that now people can actually expect to get judgment in the home countries of these corporations.
And are you confident that they will get that justice in their home countries?
I think there's really no way for Shell to escape this. They may not get 100% justice, but it's a very big milestone. People's life expectancy is a mere 41 years in the Niger Delta. So whatever level of justice that the people receive is something to be applauded.
Nemo, oil from the Delta is Nigeria's main source of wealth. Oil pretty much runs the entire country. Has the government of Nigeria ever used any of the revenue to address the oil pollution and cleaning it up?
Well, you know, there are two ways to look at that. First of all, has government been serious about stopping the pollution? I would say perhaps 20%. Since this became a major campaign issue, government has set so many deadlines for stopping gas flaring, and they keep shifting the goalposts. The first deadline was in 1984. That was shifted to the following year. And just recently, government was saying they would stop burning of gas in 2020. Suddenly, we're in 2020. And they now moved that to 2030, which is the deadline set by the World Bank for ending routine gas flaring in the oil fields. And just yesterday, the Minister of State for Petroleum in Nigeria said they will end gas flaring in 2025. There are so many deadlines, nobody believes anything. But in terms of oil spills has become a cover for oil corporations to avoid responsibility. And when I say oil corporations, I mean both international oil corporations and Nigerian oil corporations, including those being run by the government. And so the sector has simply seen the Niger Delta as a sacrifice zone, not a place to care about the people or to care about the environment, just caring about whatever revenue can be derived from that sector. unfortunately.
Well, since 1989, there have been an estimated 40 oil spills from Shell's pipelines in the region. I'd like to know, like, what that has meant for families who farm or fish there. What's that done to crops or fishing stocks? What are the changes you've seen in the landscape since you were a boy?
One must applaud the resilience of the local populations, but it's been really horrible. There are communities that have oil spills frequently, regularly. There's an oil well blowout that occurred 9 months ago, and the fire is still burning as we speak. So we're talking about a region where you have communities whose water bodies are totally contaminated with carcinogenic agents like benzene. You have soils that are contaminated up to the depth of 10 meters. You have air that is choked with poisonous gases. The fisheries are almost gone. Fishers have to go further into the high seas before they can hope to catch healthy fish. So you have a situation where local livelihoods have been crushed. The local people are either farmers or fishers, but none of this can be practiced profitably in most areas in Niger Delta today. So you're having communities that are so contaminated, children are sick, and then the oil companies are proud to say that they have corporate social responsibility projects that are building clinics. You're building health centers in contaminated communities. That, to me, is absolute nonsense.
So when you go to the market in Benin City, do you purchase fish from the Delta? And when you see fishmongers, what they're selling?
Yeah. No. Well, you know, it's actually in Benin City, you can purchase fish and hope that they're not from polluted waters because we still have, around here, we have rivers that are not contaminated. But if you go to a place like Port Harcourt, which is the oil capital of Nigeria, you would need to really be very hopeful that what you are eating is safe, because the entire environment is so toxic, people are just resigned to just eat whatever they can lay their hands on.
Nimo Bassi is an environmental justice advocate in Benin City, Nigeria. Thank you very much for speaking with us, Nimo.
Oh, thanks a lot.
In the information vacuum that marked the beginning of the COVID pandemic, rumors about the virus swirled. One example, China launched its first global disinformation campaign suggesting the U.S. created the virus as a bioweapon. That's just one of the weaponized rumors that was revealed today in a new investigation from the Associated Press and the Atlantic Council. It digs into the role governments around the globe have played in spreading disinformation about the pandemic. Jean Leroux is one of the main authors of the report and works with the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensic Research Lab in Cape Town, South Africa. What is the overall picture, Jean, of what you found in terms of the role foreign governments in general played in spreading disinformation about the pandemic?
Basically, our research and our broad investigation looked at how several of these foreign powers, that would be the US, Iran, Russia, and China, dealt with the pandemic and the coverage thereof, firstly locally, that would be domestically to their own audiences, and also more broadly, how they framed their responses to the virus in the broader global, you know, the geopolitical context in which they operated. Each of these countries approached the virus and approached their communication around the virus, quite differently. For example, the countries which had a bit more of an open and a more democratic communication system, such as the US, we found less prompting from state actors pushing conspiracies surrounding the origins of the COVID-19. Conversely, if you make the shift down to more authoritarian governments, you quickly find that the state actors and the state-adjacent media starts playing a much bigger role in amplifying the claims that the COVID-19 virus originated elsewhere and was in fact being used as a biological weapon.
So in other words, disinformation about the pandemic coming from China, Russia, and Iran, that was directed more from their governments than in the U.S., less a concerted effort made by Washington, more individuals.
Exactly, yes. I think what we found was quite interesting that in the U.S., for example, the conspiracy theorist communities and QAnon, for example, played a much bigger role in amplifying claims that China was the origin of this biological weapon that is COVID-19, then, for example, you'd find in China. What we saw was that initially, most of these governments were focused on, you know, promoting a positive image about their own responses to the virus. And gradually, as the information landscape became more congested with disinformation, they started encroaching into these narratives that the virus might have come from somewhere else as a man-made or biological weapon.
So I need to repeat for our listeners, these are false narratives that we're talking about, and we'll be mentioning a few more false narratives in this interview. So your investigation, Jean, found that China launched what might be considered its first global digital disinformation campaign about COVID right around the time that we started first hearing about the pandemic. What kind of disinformation were they spreading, and what kind of impact did it have?
I mean, initially, the Chinese response to the virus was exceptionally, you know, pro-China and trying to amplify their positive response. But what gradually happened, and from our research, it appears to be almost prompted by the U.S. response, blaming China for the outbreak of COVID-19. They gradually started taking a more antagonistic approach to the U.S. The narrative started changing from, you know, kind of accepting responsibility for the virus to shifting to firstly casting doubts about the origin of the virus, and then gradually moving over to full-on blaming the U.S. for bringing the virus to China during the 2019 Wuhan military games.
So your report came up with four false narrative buckets that you studied across millions of social media posts. One was the U.S. Army lab made it. Two, a Wuhan biolab leaked it. Three, the U.S. released it intentionally. And four, the U.S. genetically modified the virus to target specific ethnic groups. Again, these are all false. How alive, though, are any of these today?
There was one of the interesting things we saw during the investigation was that how the many of these narratives started off as something entirely different. I think we drew some of the parallels back as far as the 2003 SARS outbreak, where a lot of the same kind of narratives were used as the basis for new conspiracy theories. Our specific research and the research that informed these four buckets only took into account articles that we could find between January 2020 and June 2020. And I mean, looking back now, most of these kind of narratives have since been replaced by a lot of the vaccine skepticism and a lot of vaccine-related disinformation. And even though there might be some lingering elements and kind of long tails of these narratives still doing the rounds, they're not nearly as prominent as they were, you know, 6 months, 7 months ago.
Finally, does your report get into what could have prevented these kind of crazy salvos of disinformation?
To draw kind of a parallel with the actual pandemic itself, the best way to deal and try and negate the effect of disinformation on such a scale isn't through treatment. It'll have to be through kind of vaccinating or preventing it in the first place. Employing good digital hygiene in the form of, you know, skepticism, verifying sources is likely the way to go.
Jean Leroux from the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensic Research Lab. I've not heard that phrase before, good digital hygiene, but it does seem as important as good physical hygiene. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Marco.
Brazil has not been immune from fake news and rumors about COVID. The disinformation has been swirling as Brazil continues struggling with the pandemic. It's in the midst of a second wave of infections with more than 1,000 daily deaths. Overall, more than 200,000 people have died from the disease there, second only to the U.S. With those grim statistics, Brazil has canceled its annual carnival celebrations. No parade, no floats or flamboyant costumes. Instead, revelers have taken the festivities online, with people dressing in velvet, sequins, and feathers, and bands performing virtual concerts. Carnival usually draws millions of visitors, not to mention tourist dollars this time of year. The cancellation is an economic blow to cities like Rio de Janeiro. The mayor of Rio, Eduardo da Costa Paes, has announced financial assistance for the samba schools that worked for months to prepare for Carnival. The mayor is looking forward to next year when he says the city will be able to celebrate life and our culture with all the intensity we deserve. In the meantime, the party has moved online, with artists like Daniela Mercury, one of Brazil's biggest stars. Usually she sits atop a float in the street parades in Bahia. This year, though, she has had to resort to a surreal, colorful set where she and her bandmates performed alone. The colorful mask, though, totally on point. A different kind of carnival this year, and that's where we leave things on this Monday. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. You be safe, stay strong, and we're back with you tomorrow.
from PRX.